Hey, listen, people, listen. This is not really Yo Romero, but this is Top Turtle, episode 4. Don't forget Top Turtle. Someone give me a stool. I need to sit down.
This is Top Turtle MMA. I am your co-host, David Tremonti. I am joined by Daniel Gumby Vreeland. As always, Gumby, how are you today?
A little bit shaken up after this card this weekend.
Ryan Bader sleeps with the fishes.
Wow, I could not have been more wrong on that pick. I thought he'd go to his wrestling. Rumble wouldn't be ready for it. You know, the knock against him has been that he doesn't have the takedown defense. And for being a big, strong guy, he should have some takedown defense. And he clearly ironed out that hole because one of the better wrestlers in that division is Ryan Bader. He's probably top five, maybe top three best wrestlers at light heavyweight.
He grinded out a win over Phil Davis.
He grinded out a win over Rashad Evans.
Yeah.
I mean, like two very solid wrestlers. And they both couldn't wrestle with Ryan Bader. And sure, it was only one takedown, but man, that was scary.
You know what it kind of reminded me of? And I love how we're just getting right into this because we were both excited to talk about it. We said the name of the show. We're Top Turtle MMA. You can reach us, topturtlemma@gmail.com. You can reach us at Top Turtle MMA on Twitter. But that being said, it reminded me of the Kat Zingano-Ronda Rousey fight. When Zingano just lunged with a flying knee trying to catch her off guard.
Which is exactly the thing that I said about Ryan Bader, too, is that he's so good at not doing that. He hasn't been hit. They said he was the hardest in the light heavyweight division to hit. He's got like a 72% strike defense rate, according to Fight Metric. Love Fight Metric, too. But like... And obviously some of those stats are a little funky because like what's a defended strike right. And what isn't. But in the end of the day, he is hard to hit. And then he rushes in like that. It was kind of almost like when Bader got beat all those years ago by Machida. He got frustrated with it, sprinted in, and Machida hit him with a straight right that, you know, kept his feet moving, but his head stopped.
You know, we said it last week. I think there is something to be said, too. And I think Ryan Bader does normally have a high fight IQ, but sometimes when the bright lights are on him, I mean, you know, we said it last week. He's not going to beat Jon Jones and Daniel Cormier. He didn't make it past Rumble, who's basically the third best in that division. He's just not a top-level elite 205-er.
But... the cool thing now, too, is that Rumble is going to be that guy who's very interesting to watch because now you have to wonder how good has his takedown defense got? Because if he could stop Cormier or Jones just one or two times, he's only got to touch him once.
Right. And he did touch Cormier in that fight.
He rocked him
one time.
At least once.
And in devil's advocate to him, he also took that fight preparing for Jon Jones, and then you get handed Daniel Cormier. That's a different type of fighter you have to prepare for.
Very different. Both really good wrestlers, but the striking game is completely different.
I would definitely say that of all the rematches, and you coined the term a couple weeks ago, or the rematchaholics in this world, I would not mind seeing Rumble against Cormier again.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to, though, because I think you're going to see Jon Jones versus Rumble. And that's a big money fight for me.
That's fine. Jon Jones on his Twitter today said he had three more fights in the division before moving up. He said he had Cormier, he's going to get his title back, then Rumble, because they were supposed to fight last May before all the trouble. And he wants Gustafsson again, just to prove that that was a fluky fight where Gustafsson pushed him to the limits.
Yeah, well, the only thing he's got to be careful about saying things like that, because a lot of people have said that in their division when they're the champs, and they forget that somebody's going to make a name for themselves in the meantime. You know, like, GSP said that, like, he had weeded out the division, and he was just going to fight two or three more times.
And then Johnny Hendricks sprouted up.
Robbie Lawler came back.
Although, can we say, though, I mean, other than our boy Misha Cirkunov, 205 doesn't have a ton.
You're right. 205 doesn't have a ton. But, like, who's to say that they're not going to get one big guy? There's always one guy who's only, like, a couple of wins away. You know, Robert Whittaker is making a name for himself in the middleweight division. If you had told me 6 months ago that that was going to happen, I would laugh at you.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I'll say this. Let's just say he doesn't get to those three. You know what's interesting? I see at the top three at the light heavyweight division, Jones, Cormier, and Rumble. Here's something funny. Jones and Cormier could easily move up to heavyweight, right?
Oh, I mean, Cormier
fought there, right? And he was only there because... C-level Cain Velasquez was there, and he didn't want to fight a teammate who was the champion, but we don't know where Cain Velasquez's career is going. So there's no saying that if Cormier loses the light heavyweight title, he can't move up to heavyweight. And then at the post-fight press conference this past Saturday, Gumby, Rumble said this in passing. He said he could take a fight at heavyweight.
He has fought at heavyweight, too. You forget he fought Andre Arlovsky in World Series of Fighting.
There you go.
Yeah. So
all three of those guys could potentially take heavyweight fights, which is awesome because you know what? The heavyweight division needs some more talent.
You know, I really want to go back to like 5 years ago me and talk to him and tell him, hey, you know that welterweight you keep watching, miss weight? Yeah, he's going to be the 205 contender one day.
Right.
How did that man ever make 170 pounds? Insane. Rumble at 170? He had to have been absolutely starved.
That's true. Good point. All right, so moving on to the next fight, speaking of the heavyweight division, Ben Rothwell choked out with a go-go choke Josh frickin' Barnett. Who saw that coming?
He fucking tapped him out. This guy, Josh Barnett tapped out Dean Lister, who's one of the greats in jiu-jitsu right now. One of the most dominant every time he fights Metamoris.
Never submitted in MMA. The last time he submitted in a jiu-jitsu competition was, I think, ADCC 2000. So you're talking about like 17 years
without tapping.
Right.
And then of all people, that's the same choke Meathead tapped to. Am I wrong?
It is. It's the same one. They call it a go-go choke.
What the hell? I know. How did this happen?
I do have to say, I think sometimes, you know, it was funny in the two fights because I think the narrative going into both the co-headliners was that if Bader could survive the first round and a half, he'd grind out a win. A lot of people felt that way. Okay, he didn't. Spoiler alert. He went to sleep. And the other kind of like lock of the night was, well, Rothwell won't choke out Barnett like he did Meathead. Guess what? He did.
He did.
It's shocking, right?
There's pretty much nothing more than I can say than get my voice really high and yell like I was a second ago. It's just absurd to me that it happened.
This is what it proves to me, though. I think sometimes, you know, there's a limited amount of outcomes in MMA. There's a TKO, a KO, a submission, a draw, a judge's decision, right? And there are a million ways to get there. But I can't, you know, to me, like when we were talking about it, I'm like, yeah, no way Rothwell will ever submit him. But you know what? I've seen Rothwell submit a heavyweight with that same choke. And I know Matt Mitrione and Josh Barnett are on far ends of the spectrum of the jiu-jitsu game. But I guess it just proves to me that when I see something one time that a high-level competitor can pull off that choke, I don't know. I'm never doubting Ben Rothwell's submission skills again is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, he is just by far the person I've had the worst read on in the history of MMA.
Yeah. He's been, not just you. He has been an underdog in the last four wins that he's had.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind.
In like very impressive wins. You knock out. Let's just talk about this from a pure, if you're talking one martial art sake. He knocked out maybe the best kickboxer in heavyweight MMA.
Alistair
Overeem. And he submitted maybe the best jiu-jitsu guy in the heavyweight. Like,
yeah, it's Barnett or Mir, right?
It's either Barnett or Mir. And it's either, like, you know, if we're talking kickboxing, it's probably Overeem or Marcon.
Right.
And he knocked out Overeem, and he submitted Josh Barnett.
Unbelievable.
It's just the weirdest resume you've ever heard in your life.
Here's where I go from here for them. You book, if they have to just get it out of their system to book C-level Cain versus Verdum in a couple of months on that same card, if I'm them, as an insurance policy, I'm booking Stipe versus Rothwell. And that way, if either Cain or Verdum pull the chicanery they pulled a month ago, you just sub in one of Rothwell or Stipe
for the title. I think you're wrong on that. I like all four of them on
Travis
the same
Brown's
card.
Going to be in there?
Nope. I like all four of those of them on the same card, but I think Cain's lost his chance. I think they're going to make Cain fight again before they give him a title shot again. I mean, he got whooped in the first one and tapped. He got his instant rematch. He wasn't ready for his instant rematch. Back to the line.
I like that. Yep. I actually do like that.
And in my opinion, the matchups they're going to go with are probably Stipe Verdum, Rothwell Cain.
Right.
I would much rather see, and you can call me crazy, because if you told me I was going to say this a week ago, I would have called you crazy. I want to see Rothwell Verdum. And I know that sounds crazy, and I'm sorry if you're listening, Stipe, because I apologize. I know you've been fighting for that title shot for so long, but from a stylistic standpoint,
it'd be interesting.
He just tapped out Josh Barnett. Could he at least defend against Verdum? Could he box with Verdum? Could he knock out Verdum?
I need to know.
Right.
And as far as somebody to match up with Kane, I know Stipe's wrestling is probably the best equipped. So I think that's more fun stylistically. I don't think they're going to do that, but man, I wish they would.
I think that's a great point. And I think timing, it all depends on timing and who's coming back when. I guess you could also just do Stipe versus Rothwell, number one contender fight. And then that person gets Verdum in June at 199. I don't know.
And then Kane's still waiting.
Yep. All right, so that was the heavyweight offering, and then really the third biggest fight of the night, you had super shirtless Sage Northcutt taking on Brian Barberina. Barberina was the largest underdog on the card, and Brian Barberina tapped out Sage Northcutt with a head and arm choke from half guard.
Going on the wrong side,
diagonally on the wrong side. Wow.
Yeah, and for those of you who aren't technical jiu-jitsu people, when you finish a head and arm choke, typically you try to get your body to the same side you have it locked up. If you look, I mean, the top half of his body is, but also the leg on that same side is locked up, which means not only could he not get his body to the appropriate side, but his other leg is also on the wrong side. So one is locked up, one is on the wrong side. And
there's less leverage. He claims he catches it all the time in training, but you could literally see, I mean, we're going to sound like such jiu-jitsu nerds here, but you can literally see that one carotid artery is not actually closed up on
his,
stage.
Yeah, his right side. You're right. Talking about his right side. His right side, if you look at where his arm is, there's a lot of space in between his arm, which should be crushing his own carotid artery. And there's just air there.
Yeah, and there are a lot of fighters on Twitter, so this isn't just two nerds in a basement talking shop or what have you. I mean, we're both jiu-jitsu nerds, but a lot of fighters said this was about heart.
I think 100%. And you're not, a bunch of people also took to Twitter and were like, he's a huge pussy. You know, he has no heart. You know, look, I think he's 19 years old.
Yeah, he might have just panicked in a big moment.
And I think exactly that's what he did. You know, like, you can say that he didn't have heart. You can say he's a pussy. You can say he can't take being pushed around a little bit. But I think in the end, this is about the fact that he's 19 years old. Finally, the bright lights caught up to him, and he panicked.
Yeah.
And if you look at the tap, too, it looks like a panic tap.
It looked like a panic tap. I agree completely. Now, here's the thing I will say on the plus side. In that fight, he tagged Brian Barberina a few times. His stand-up looks good. He has a power double. I hate to say it, and jiu-jitsu is where my heart is. It's what I love the most about MMA. But if I was building the perfect MMA fighter, you know, jiu-jitsu might be one of the last things I teach them. I think it's one of the easier things to learn as an adult, whereas wrestling and striking, I think, is harder for an adult to take to.
I would agree with that. We also have to remember he's not an adult. I mean, like,
right.
You know,
that's true.
I mean,
19. He's still in college.
He's part-time. He's just started college. Like, not still in college, just started college.
But, so to me, it's like, listen, okay, he'll go to TriStar for a couple of years. They'll bring in Damian Maya for a fight camp one day. Like, look at Rumble. Look at what Rumble did in that sprawl, and then when he got on top and mounted. He'll learn that stuff. I wonder about the heart thing. I wonder about all the hype going too fast thing. But if you got to tell me that the one thing Sage Northcutt has to work on is submissions and submission defense, he'll get that.
Yeah, well, I agree that it probably would be pretty easy for him to pick up, especially as a super athletic kid. My one worry is he tried TriStar. He went up there. Nobody knows the story. He's not there anymore.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wait, was Zahabi in his corner this Saturday?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
I would have to go back and watch, but I know he went up to TriStar. They said he worked out there for a week or two. He saw freaking pictures all over Twitter of him with Zahabi and GSP and Rory McDonald and this guy and that guy. And they said he's no longer with TriStar. He's back in Katy, Texas.
Interesting.
And if you listen to where they announced him training out of, it was not out of Montreal, Quebec, Canada. By way of Katy, Texas, it was training out of Katy, Texas. And it's a Gracie Barra Katy, but I hope he goes somewhere else. He needs to learn that while dad might coach at Katy or, you know, he's got some kind of allegiance to it, it's time to leave. He needs to be at American Top Team. He needs to be at Henzo Gracie. He needs to be at Sarah Lulongo, whatever.
I do wonder with a guy like that and all the marketing dollars behind him, and it sounds like his dad has been very influential, positive or negative, throughout his whole life. I do wonder who's in his ear? What are they telling him about what he needs? Is he surrounded by yes men who's just saying he's great? because he certainly needs some submission skills, submission grappling.
I'd like to think that if Dana knows what he's got there, you know, Dana knows he's got an unpolished 19-year-old who needs a piece or two more to his game. I'd like to think Dana would probably be honest with him because Dana wants him to be better.
Right. So yeah. Dana's probably instructing him, hey, you know, go right now to one of the major camps. And I do have to say, too, that, you know, when people said Connor doesn't have takedown skills or he can't defend takedowns or he doesn't have submission skills, he's with John Kavanaugh, who's the first black belt in Europe.
John Kavanaugh's a beast.
A beast. So I don't like when people make that comparison. Connor had, you know, he out wrestled Max Holloway on a bad knee. We've seen Connor flash. You know, he got out of Chad Mendez's guillotine attempt.
Yep.
So it's just different. So it's not the same as Connor when people were saying he didn't have submission skills. This is like a clear deficiency, whereas with Connor, we were just kind of guessing because we had never seen it tested. But now along the way, we've seen it tested a bit. And also, I'll say this, Gumby, it's not the same as Paige VanZant. I know everyone wants to lump them together because they were like the Ken and Barbie marketing team, Sage and Paige. But Paige's loss in December, she looked like a badass with the beating she took. The fact that you can't armbar her, not the same.
Well, the other piece of that, too, is you got to remember that Paige VanZant loses that fight to a top three in her division.
Right.
You know, he's losing. Not that I don't like Barbarina, but he is, you know, he's probably down.
He lost to an underdog.
Yeah, he's probably to the 30s and 40s in that division, maybe 50s in that division. And there's no shame in that. But in the end of the day, we need to stop comparing Sage Northcutt's fall to X, Y, and Z because we've never had somebody who has fought two of the lowest level guys in the UFC beat them and still had this kind of hype around it.
Yeah, and the massive pay structure, which is out of whack. I mean, and there have been losses in young careers, and I'll go back to, and this was a different stage in his career. GSP was a very hype prospect out the gates, and he lost his first title defense. And it was a career-defining loss. He came back stronger. He said he learned from it. And he went on to have a great career. This could be something. Now, it wasn't as, you know, bright lights, per se, as losing to Matt Serra, like when GSP lost the title that time. But he can come back from this loss, learn a ton, and go off and unravel 10 wins in a row for all we know.
And we'd hope, you know, for a 19-year-old who's got such a good spirit like that, that he does learn something from this. And maybe it's that camp change that we talked about.
Right. And now, speaking of camps and coaches and great coaches, I had the pleasure of catching up with MMA Lab's John Crouch.
Excellent coach. I know I'm a big fan of MMA Lab and all of the fighters down there, really.
He's Benson Henderson's head coach.
Yep. And Brian Barberena.
And Brian Barberena. So this was taped on Saturday morning before the fights. I asked him about what Brian Barberena was bringing to the table, and you will hear some very prophetic words from John Crouch right now.
But before we get to that, we've got to have that interview brought to you by somebody. And our first interview is brought to you by Sisu Mouthguards. Sisu Mouthguards are the most breathable, lightweight mouthguards that you could ever ask for.
So breathable. So lightweight.
David's got one. I've got one. We're heading to open mat right after we finish up this show. We're going to pop in our Sisu mouthguards, roll around, and still be able to breathe, unlike our counterparts who might have those gummy, nasty, rubbery ones that wind up smelling kind of funky after you've worn them a couple of times. So head to their website, sisuguard.com. That's SISUguard.com. Pick yourself up one.
I can't believe I tried to cut to this interview without the assistance of Sisu. Sisu Mouthguards brings you our interview with John Crouch. This is David Tremonti with Top Turtle MMA Podcast, and on the phone with me, I have a legendary name in the BJJ community. He is a black belt under Royce Gracie. He is one of the most respected MMA coaches in the MMA universe. I am talking to John Crouch. John, how are you today?
Good. What's happening, man?
2 weeks ago, you were in Boston for your fighter, Luke Sanders, and now today you are in Newark for Brian Barberena and Alex Caceres. One, I hope you are getting a lot of frequent flyer miles, and how has the back and forth been for you?
It's been okay. It seems like everything is East Coast this month. You know, we're in Boston now. Now we're out here in Jersey, and then I have London and then Pittsburgh. So it seems like everything's a cross-country trip for me this month. But otherwise, it's good. It's, you know, the travel comes as a punishment or a reward for having done your job well. So we're happy to travel.
That's a great way to look at it. So 2 weeks ago, Luke Saunders made his UFC debut in impressive fashion. He showed knockdown power. He ended up getting a submission win and a performance of the night bonus. How happy were you for him? And is he walking around the gym with a little extra pep in his step?
I was super happy for him, but I've been talking about Luke for a couple of years now. Like, he's been long overdue to get in the UFC. So I think it was expected.
Yeah.
You know, I was psyched for him, and I expected when he went in he was going to do good things.
Now, tonight, you have Brian Barberina, who's 1-1 in the UFC, but much like Luke Saunders, he's taking a fight on short notice against maybe the most hyped prospect in the history of the universe, Sage Northcutt. Brian is the largest underdog on the card tonight, but what might the world be overlooking? What does Brian bring to the table? How do you see him matching up against Sage?
Brian's super tough, man. He's pretty good everywhere, and he's a tough character. He's going to be there the whole time. He's going to fight hard the whole time, and he brings pressure, and he likes to get in there and thump. He's definitely not going to be overwhelmed by the situation. So I feel like it's a good matchup for us, and we're excited about it.
So, you know, switching more to overall coaching philosophy, I wonder, when a young fighter comes up, such as a Brian Barberina or a Luke Saunders, they could look to someone like a GSP, a BJ Penn, someone they could try to model their career after. As a coach, who do you draw inspiration from? Is there anyone you look to as far as your career when it comes to inspiration and modeling your career after them?
Well, I think, you know, the standard in our industry is Greg Jackson, and he's a super great guy. He's always been available for any questions I have. Like, he's a great human being. He's a good coach, and he's doing good things with his team. But he's a very kind guy, and he's been helpful to me. So I'll say I look up to him. But really, there's a bunch of coaches that I see every week at the UFC, and they're so smart. I just talked with Eric Del Fierro from Alliance, and, you know, did a great job with Dominic Cruz. Always has done a really good job with his team. Henry Hooft and the Black Zillions, you know, I mean, those are guys I just saw. I just walked past them in the lobby. That's why their names are in my mind. But, sure. You know, I love to watch them work, and I steal tricks from every single person I see in the warm-up room every time I go. So I would say pretty much all these guys.
Yeah,
are guys I look up to and I try to emulate.
Absolutely. So when you watch a fight now, say you're at home on the couch with your family and you're watching a fight card, doesn't have to necessarily be from the UFC, but you don't have anyone from MMA Lab fighting, are you still able to enjoy fights, or is your brain just always in overdrive looking at things and trying to pick up on competition, et cetera?
No, I kind of just watch. I mean, you know, you pick up some things, but unless it's somebody we're going to fight, like usually – I have 3 kids, so sitting through anything for more than 10 minutes isn't possible at my house.
Sure.
So unless we're focused on somebody specifically, I try to just watch and, again, listen to the corners and see what kind of strategy is going on. But it's definitely hard to sit. I don't sit through a whole fight event at my house. It's impossible.
Understood completely. You know, a couple of months back in the Ronda Rousey Holly Holm fight, so much was made about the corner advice Ronda received going into round two after most people would agree she lost round one. Now, the devil's advocate there is obviously that her coach might have just thought, Edmund Tavardian, that's what she needed to hear in the moment. How do you weigh what you tell fighters between rounds? Do you look to say, hey, you're down here? Do you not want to cause panic? Would you might not point to what you think the judge's scorecard is? How do you try to weigh, you know, honesty versus keeping their head in the game?
I've always been fairly honest if it comes to it. But I think it just depends on the athlete, you know, and the coach, their relationship. I think you have to be sensitive to what they need to hear. And if you feel like you need to hear something positive, you know, and that round had gone very badly for Ronda, and maybe she just needed something to buoy her at that point, you know, and to feel, you know, maybe he felt she needed to hear some positive words. So maybe that was it. I don't know. I would hate to second guess somebody that's had, you know, those guys have had a lot of success in the sport. But for me, honesty is usually the best policy. I find that minute in the corner to be one of the most overrated times in sports.
Is that right? Just because there's not really much you can say, and what's happening is going to unfold regardless of words.
Yeah, I think you've done your work, you know, and I think sometimes you can help a little bit and point out certain things, and depending on the presence of your athlete, you know, how in the moment they are and able to receive that, then that will help. But I think for the most part, everybody wants to be Newt Rockne, you know, you want to say these magic words and have, you know, a sword sprout out of their hand and wings sprout and they're good to go. But most of the time you've done your work and we just want to make sure they breathe and relax, and settle down and get started again. So I think that minute, you know, while it's easy to analyze it from an outside perspective and really put a spotlight on it, I don't think it makes a whole lot of difference in there.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting way of looking at it. Fascinating. As far as trends in the coaching game, do you get caught up in any of this, obviously, with Connor recently, and I think Carlos Condit as well, over at Greg Jackson's, with the movement coaches? I'm sure you've heard about it. Is it something you've potentially thought about bringing into MMA Lab? Is that something that you have interest in?
I'm interested in anything that makes the fighters better. You know what I mean? I think... Yeah. We have a very good strength and conditioning coach at our gym, and he has a lot of good movement principles in there. We don't have some guru who's, you know, living on a mountaintop somewhere that has the secrets of it. But, you know, but if that helps Connor think that he's the best thing ever, then I think that's a positive thing. And so, you know, we definitely have looked at some stuff and tried to incorporate a couple of things in our training. But, you know, our sport is so overreactive, you know, our sport has ADD badly, and you know, we see something and everybody runs to see it and do it, and then there's something, no, look at that, look at this.
Right.
And really it's like the people that can hold the course and keep consistently put good information out there, that hasn't really changed. So it's nice to add a little bit of this or a little bit of that, but no, we didn't drastically vary what we were doing.
Understood. So, you know, you have a fighter, Yautsen Meza. He's about a month out from a fight in London versus Arnold Allen. Take us through, you know, for the fans at home, when you're a month out of a fight, where is he in his training camp now? I imagine film work is probably done. You've studied the fighter. He's probably doing some hard sparring that'll taper off about a week out of the fight. But where would a fighter find themselves in training about a month out? What's going on right now in a fight camp?
Basically, you do, you know, your morning session, strength and conditioning, whatever that, you know, the body conditioning is in the morning. And then we do our protein practice at 3:30 in the afternoon. And that's a team-oriented, you know, wrestling practice, stand-up practice. We spar. Our stand-up sparring days are twice a week. Our stand-up sparring is on Wednesday, and then we do our MMA sparring on Saturdays. So, you know, we take Fridays off, but most of the guys will... you know, do a light something. It's sort of on your own day, like, you know, stay busy, go for a hike, go for a swim, something that's non-impactful on your body. And then Saturday's car crash day when we spar hard for MMA rounds.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then Sunday's, you know, rest, relax, and then we hit it back on Monday. So Yachty's doing two-a-days. The thing that's interesting about Yachty is that he is, he works full-time for the city.
Wow.
And so he holds, he goes to work at like 5 o'clock in the morning. He gets off for his lunch, comes and does his strength and conditioning, goes back to work, finishes work, comes to protein practice, and then goes to wrestling practice with his kids. So that's a real man right there. That guy is an incredible grinder, and he is one of the hardest working people I've ever known in my life.
That is unbelievable. Props to him.
Yeah, it is. He'll take the last couple of weeks off, but he's amazing. He really is. Just to watch him and how he never falters and he always works hard. It's a real inspiration.
You know, one of your, arguably your most famous fighter out of MMA Lab, Benson Henderson, he's a free agent now. I don't expect you to give us any scoops, but I did wonder, do you as a coach weigh in on the decision he has in front of him now as far as what organization might court him and make him an offer? Or is that something you just leave to the managers and the financial people? Is that something you might put an opinion in on?
For sure. I put my opinion in there all the time. I'm not a shy person. But with Benson, I am part of his management team. So that's a little more unique situation.
I see.
With the other guys, I don't really care too much. I don't want to be a manager. I do help manage their careers, and with some of the managers in the business, I really like speaking with them. And we all put our brains together and do the best for our fighters. And I think that's a very positive thing. You know, when the trainers and the managers and the fighters are all together, you know, those three, four brains are way better than one. And we get a lot of good stuff done. So with that being said, Benson's situation is unique.
Yeah, and then you have the whole team pulling together for one motive as opposed to three people with their own motives for that fighter. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, you get different perspectives, you know, like the manager's thinking something and, you know, I'm thinking something and the guy's thinking something. And so if those three things aren't, you know, they don't meet somewhere, then somebody has either hard feelings or disappointment or whatever. So we can all just be real open and get it out there. I try to be as open and honest with the guys as I can, you know, in helping them with their training or whatever. And so once we can all talk about it, then nobody's surprised. And if you're not surprised, that's a good thing.
Absolutely. All right. Well, John, last question here. Your mentor, the man who gave you a black belt, is actually fighting in 3 weeks. Hoyce Gracie will be fighting Ken Shamrock in late February. Have you done any training with him on that? Have you spoken with him about the fight at all? Do you know where he's at in his camp and his preparations for that fight?
You know, I don't. When I heard it announced, I sent him a text and, you know, told him if he needed anything that we're 100% behind him. And he texted me back and said, thanks. So, you know, looking forward to it. And that's been about it. So he has a very set, you know, way of doing things. Hoyce has done it. He's done this a few times. So
right.
His brother Hoyler runs his camp. And I think I don't know where he's at exactly. I think he's in L.A. He must be at Kings a little bit. I don't know exactly. But I think he's got a good idea and he's well organized. I'm sure he'll be ready to go.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, John, I can't thank you enough for the time. We know it's a busy day here on fight night. Best of luck to you and your guys tonight. And thank you once again.
All right. Thank you, brother. Appreciate it.
Thank you, John. So big honor to interview John Crouch. He took time out of his busy day on Saturday getting ready for Alex Caceres' fight, which he won, and of course Brian Barberina's fight, which he won in a big way. I didn't think he'd give us the scoop on Benson Henderson, but I did ask him about it. He said he's part of the management team and that he did weigh in with his opinion on where Benson should go. He didn't tell me which way he was leaning or which opinion he gave, but here we are on Monday, 2 days after the interview, and breaking news, Benson Henderson signed with Bellator, Gumby.
Yeah, I want to say that I'm surprised too, but really in the end, I'm not surprised. The UFC most likely lowballed him a little bit. Because to the UFC, he's a former champ at lightweight who seems to have given up on lightweight. You know, why overpay for a guy who's probably not big enough or strong enough to become the 170 champ and his time's kind of passed at 55?
Right. The only way I could see the UFC, I don't think the UFC should overpay for him, but where a Benson Henderson comes into such a value for a company like the UFC that's expanding and running a ton of shows each year is Benson Henderson will pick up a fight on short notice and he can easily headline a fight night, a fight pass card.
He does sell fights.
Yeah.
That's the one thing you can say for him is that he is the kind of guy who sells fights pretty well. Bellator wants to make a big point out of this that they're going to be able to steal talent. And I'll tell you the other thing that seems to be a benefit almost for the UFC out of all of this is that there is still that lingering idea behind of an antitrust suit.
I thought the same thing. Let him walk to make it look like the UFC is quote-unquote
unable to sign him.
Right.
And at this point in time, you would have to argue that the people who want to run that antitrust suit just took a huge blow to their case.
Right.
Because Benson Henderson, former champ, walking away, even though the UFC reportedly had offered him some money, whatever that sum was, that it's definitely not, you know, a monopoly.
Right. Now, let me ask you this question, Gumby. Of the three, call them big free agents right now, because I'm not going to count Matt Mitrione at age 37, but out of Benson Henderson, Aljamain Sterling, and Alistair Overeem, for the UFC side of things, who was the must-re-sign of those three guys?
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say Alistair Overeem, and here's why. My thought process behind that is the UFC has to think about it from a loss standpoint, Okay, the must sign is not necessarily who they have to sign so that they can promote them, because the UFC's got 100 guys that they could promote at any time, and people will buy it. It's from who somebody else can sell. And don't get me wrong, Bellator can sell Benson Henderson. Alistair Overeem sells himself.
Here's the other thing. Alistair Overeem's coming off a big knockout of JDS, the UFC's former champion.
And that's the other thing, too, is he's almost seems like, out of those three, the only one who has even the slightest claim that he could be the best at his weight class.
Right, because Aljamain Sterling, and I'll talk about Aljamain Sterling in a second, huge fan, but he doesn't have a claim right now to being the best.
No.
And neither does Benson Henderson.
He would need something to build him up, and I think there are some Bellator 135ers that he could beat that would build him up, but not to the point where you're like, damn, he's the best at 135. Until he beats Dominic Cruz, or until he beats TJ Dillashaw, nobody is ever going to see him as the best 135er. Now, if Alistair Overeem walked right now, he's beat the UFC champ, he beat the former UFC champ on the way to the top, and you got to be wondering, is he the best?
Right. And he's also, first of all, heavyweights always sell better than a bantamweight.
Any
lighter weight, right. And he's also Overeem is a big name in Japan. And that's a market that, I always want to call him Strikeforce, that Bellator is in co-promotion with Ryzen.
Yeah, and he's also a huge sell in Europe, being from Europe. And Bellator recently announced that they're thinking about going to England. They've said that for a while, but it seems a little bit more legitimate now that they're gaining steam behind some of these freak show fights that they put together.
Now, I would say from Bellator's perspective, I almost wish if they were really going to put together a case as the number two promotion and really make a run, it almost seems like they're going piecemeal on what they can get. Like, they got a Phil Davis for 205. Maybe they get a Ream for heavyweight. They got a Benson Henderson at 155, 170. I almost wish they could, like, pick one division and just load that up with talent, because I really don't think that taking all these guys in different divisions, ex-UFC guys, is going to ever get them over the hump as a legitimate number two tied for number one. You know what I'm trying to say?
I will say that I think they think that 130 or 155 is that for them, though.
Because of Chandler.
Because of Chandler.
Now Benson.
Benson. Will Brooks. They had
Paul Daly is
no, Paul Daly 70.
Yeah, okay, fine.
Which, I mean, you could fight Paul Daly and Benson Henderson.
I'd watch it on a Friday night, Spike TV.
Sure, absolutely. I feel like they're hovering around there. They've kind of tried to make moves in their heavyweight division. But you're right. There's no division in Bellator that you could be like, damn, that's damn near as good as the UFC.
I know they're into the freak show fights and the fights that people are going to watch the next day on the internet, on YouTube, what have you. Forget about the whole roster, because that's not going to happen. But if they could just focus on one division and build out from there, I'd be very interested to see. They just signed that wrestling prospect, Pico. But I think he's also like 145 or something.
It doesn't matter how big he is. He's got no MMA fights.
Right.
Like, I'll care later.
Right. Yeah. So, I don't know. That was my thinking on the Bellator side. Now, you said Overeem was the must sign. I'm going to make just a quick argument here. I agree with you that Overeem would be the biggest hit. To me, the mustery sign is actually Aljamain Sterling, because they're looking for exciting fighters at the lighter weight divisions. They're looking for exciting fighters who can talk. The dude's nickname is the Funk Master. Now, he's not big yet, okay? He doesn't have, like, a ton of Twitter followers. He has one win over a top five opponent, I think, which was Misugaki at number six. But to me, Aljamain Sterling is someone they could build the future of the bantamweight division around. And I don't know. I just think, you might take a huge hit losing Benson and Overeem right now. You're not going to notice it with Aljamain. But I think where you miss it is in 2 years when Dominic Cruz is retired, or maybe TJ Dillashaw is on his way out. That's where I'd want to see Funkmaster at 135.
Yeah, I definitely think the potential later on is much higher.
Is higher with Aljamain, right. But Overeem is definitely the biggest hit right now. And with that said, we will transition now to Gumby catching up with John Wood.
Yeah, I certainly didn't want to let you have all of the interview fun this go round. So I got to sit down with Syndicate MMA's head MMA coach, John Wood, who talks us a little bit about what goes on at a typical fight camp and gives us a little bit of an inside taste of the three fighters or three of the big fighters he's got with matches coming up.
And who brings us this interview, Gumby?
This interview will be brought to you by GrapplersToolbox.com. GrapplersToolbox.com. Get yourself a whole bunch of mixed bag goodies filled with all of the essentials you need for the grappler in your life.
If you're a grappler, you're basically just going to want to get this toolbox. It's got soap to keep you from getting mat herpes.
It's got Sisu mouth guards.
Sisu mouth guards, another one of our sponsors. It has
tape, balms, all the kind of stuff you need.
Everything you need to be a grappler. Go over there, get yourself a grappler's toolbox, and why don't you, while you're there, enter in promo code
Manifesto, because promo code Manifesto will get you 15% off.
Nice. All right. So with that being said, brought to you by Grappler's Toolbox, here is Gumby catching up with John Wood.
This is Daniel Gumby Vreeland with Top Turtle MMA. I'm here with Syndicate MMA coach John Wood, who's a coach of lots of famous UFC fighters as well as other fighters. And he's going to give us a little bit of inside intake on what it looks like in a fight camp. So, John, we'll get right into it. When you watch a fight now, even if it's not one of your fighters, does your brain instantly go to breaking it down and looking for holes, or do you still able to enjoy fights?
You know, I actually do. Most of the time, I'm breaking down what they're doing right or what they're doing wrong. Some fights, you know, I can get into, but yeah, the coach brain is hard to shut off these days. It's pretty much always on. But I still do enjoy fights, and when I'm not having to work and when I can actually sit at home or if I'm in the crowd just watching, I still enjoy fighting a lot.
I want you to take us a little bit through what a typical training camp looks like. So you've got a couple of fighters with fights coming up. Vinny Magalhaes, your BJJ coach, or your no-gi BJJ coach, is supposed to fight April 9th against Houston Alexander over in mm-hmm. Chechnya. About 2 months out of a scheduled fight, what does the training look like for that?
Well, you know, everybody does their camps a little different. Some guys like to get in 10 weeks, some guys 8 weeks, 6 weeks. For the most part, you know, the first couple weeks of training camp, say, is kind of, you know, reacclimating to getting your body used to fight training. Most of the guys stay. I'm really, really heavy on my guys about staying in the gym. You know, you get a fight, get out, take a week or two off, heal up, but get back in, especially if they're anything just to help your partners and keep them, you know, going. But just kind of reacclimating and started getting in, you know, that 8 weeks in the first 8 weeks, you know, the first couple weeks there, you're trying to just kind of get your body back used to getting that mindset of hard training. And then by 6 weeks, you know, 6 weeks in, we're full on, kicking into fight gear, you know, really kind of game planning, breaking down what we want to do for this fight, the things we want to improve, you know, the things that we're looking to, take advantage of against our opponent, and, you know, just start stepping in that hard training, strength and conditioning, all these things. There's a ton of stuff that goes into fight camp. Everybody has their own little tweaks and, you know, things that they like to do. But for the most part, you know, by 6 weeks, it's a full grind. You know, we're getting everything sharpened up, conditioning, weight training, cardio, you know, all your running, all your mitt time, everything. It's a lot more involving than the average person realizes.
Yeah, and so you mentioned that you're not really game planning until about 6 weeks out. Does that mean you usually wait until then to start looking at film of the opponents, or is that something you start a little bit earlier?
So for me, I mean, I start looking as soon as I know the opponent, I'll start looking. A lot of guys just don't like to focus on that opponent or over-focus, and they get, you know, obsessed with it. It becomes a thing. Like, I find a lot of my guys don't really like to start doing that kind of stuff till about 6 weeks out, just to kind of keep their mind not so focused on this one thing. And for me, as a coach, I do it a little bit backwards. I look at more of my tape of my guys, their last couple fights, and I look for the weaknesses that if I was coaching against them, what I would try to pick apart, what I would try to do, you know, against them. And I try to shore up those holes and make sure that, you know, isn't going to happen. And I assume that that's happening for the other fighter too. I'll look for glaring weaknesses in our opponents. If there's something that, you know, they're doing in round two or three repetitively when they're tired and they go back to their, you know, their roots or whatever it is, I'll pick those things out if I see something, like I said, a glaring, you know, thing that just keeps standing out. But for the most part, you know, I kind of game plan overall for everything. You're never going to know what is going to happen in a fight. You might train, you might have the best guy in the world on the ground, and all of a sudden, you know, he's been training for the last 6 months at becoming the best striker. You never know. Everybody's improving. This game is always, you know, changing and evolving. So I hate sending my guys out there with one game plan where it's, this is what you're going to do and how you're going to do it and stick to it, because I've seen so many fighters and so many coaches when the game plan fails that they're standing there, oh, shit, you know, what do I do now? And they just turn to mush in the cage and get their ass whooped. So game plan for certain specific things that you see, but not over game plan to where, you know, I have game plan A, B, C, D. You know, if we get out there, and the Lawler fight is always a great example for me. His last fight against Vellante, you know, there were certain things that I picked out of Vellante that every fight, you know, I've seen when you go after Vellante, he would back up and go straight back to the cage. He'd back straight up. So there was, you know, that was kind of part of the deal, is that we were going to attack heavy and get him back to the cage and grind on him a little bit and, you know, wear him out. Well, we went out there and that dude didn't take one step backwards, you know, not one step. And I mean, he held the cage and he was, you know, the bigger guy, and he was trying to bully Tom and get on Tom. But fortunately, we work a ton of counter fighting, a ton of, you know, working our angles, punching backwards, you know, how to lure guys into stuff. So that's how, you know, Tom ended up getting the KO off of a counter right hook. So,
yeah,
you know, always just have, you know, lots of game plans.
Yeah, very impressive KO there too. So you spoke a lot about game plans there, and usually about 6 weeks out is when you're coming up with those. How much say does the average fighter have in their own game plan? How much do they leave up to you? And does it, you know, vary based on, you know, obviously you've got Tom Lawler who coaches some classes out there for you, and Vinny Magalhaes does as well. Is it different for them versus other fighters?
Yeah, you have some guys. I mean, you have some guys that you're going to sit down and watch some tape with, or you guys are going to kind of collaborate, you know, with them. And they're going to, you know, really try to, implement those game plans. And then you have some guys that just, dude, no matter what you do, they're going to get the same thing every time. You're going to have a guy you can game plan. They're going to go out there and do what they want to do. And I do have some fighters like that, that just, no matter what you try to fix or what you try to do, or they look great, you know, during camp, and they're doing all this stuff and doing, you know, improved on all the stuff they want to improve and get in the cage, and they just do exactly what they always do, you know. So it varies from fighter to fighter. It really does. You have some guys that are just like, I really want to get better at this, actively try, and, you know, they're trying it sparring, they're trying it in all their, you know, drilling, and then they get out there and they perform it. And then you have some guys that are just like, I'm going to do what I want to do and see how it goes.
Awesome. So you kind of touched on, you know, where Tom and Vinny might be as far as their camps, you know, one being about 5 weeks out, one being about 8 weeks out. You got Mike Pyle fighting Saturday, and obviously it's a little bit of an advantage because you're close to where he's fighting. But what is he doing now to fine-tune himself right there at the end of his fight camp?
So the last few weeks, especially this week, it's a lot of specific drills, specific oriented flow drills. You know, we're not doing anything. I really try to get my guys as healthy as they can to the cage. In fact, I don't think we had one where Tom actually had to pull out of the Maldonado fight because he took a headbutt, clashed heads, and got a really bad concussion. That happened to be on one day that I was out of town for a fight, and I wasn't there to coach.
Blame it on the backup.
But he, in fact, I think he was coaching that day, actually. So, you know, can't blame Tom. Maybe you can blame Tom, but whatever. So, you know, I tried it the last week or two. You know, you see all these fighters that get injured before fights. You have to structure, you know, one of the most important things to fighting is actually being able to fight, get to the fight. So it's controlling. I have a lot of control with what we do and toning it down to the end, but keeping the mind sharp, keeping the body in shape, cardio up and everything. But really, really a lot of, like, for this week with Pyle, you know, I'll be back in tonight with him, and we'll do a lot of controlled stuff that we've been working on in flow drills on the ground and just moving around and really picking who your partner is with. And a lot of times for me, you know, it ends up being me training with these guys because they know I'm not going to hurt them and vice versa. Well, sometimes they hurt me quite often, but it's okay. That's part of the job. But, yeah, so just right now, like this week will be a lot of mental prep, a lot of sharpening up the, you know, the final stages, but everything, all the hard work, everything's been done. So it's now just keeping the mind sharp, keeping the weight down, getting a good sweat and keeping everything, you know, on track and ready to go.
Awesome. So, you mentioned a little bit about, the mental side of things and, looking other places to do just like the basics. There are a lot of coaches out there that are moving on to these, you know, current hip trends, movement coaches, you know, big nutritional coaches. Do you ever feel caught up in all of that, or do you just stick to what you do and know it works?
You know, there's a lot of specialty coaches in the sport in general. You know, everybody's a specialized coach at something. Nutrition and all that stuff and the weight and the condition, and that's a very important part, and it's good. There's a lot of cutting edge stuff out there with those kind of guys that are getting into it, and I don't mind my guys if they have a nutritionalist or, you know, a strength and conditioning coach. I know how to do the basic stuff coming up, what I did, you know, and I'm a firm believer of, first off, getting in shape on the mat. You know, if you're training to fight, then you need to be doing fight-specific training, and then everything else kind of comes secondary to that. And so I don't mind my guys. You know, Pyle has a strength and conditioning coach, you know, and we have a couple strength and conditioning coaches here in the gym facility that they use. Diet, it's not rocket science. There's a lot of good dietitians out there, but I mean, it really isn't like, you know, oh my God, it's all been done before. It's finding kind of trial and error what works for your guys. So if my guys need help in those areas, I'm glad to point them in the right direction. And, you know, I've worked with Dolce a lot in the past, a good friend of mine. He's out here. You know, I've been fortunate to work with him and a bunch of other really good guys and kind of formulate what has worked for me, and I'll kind of pass that on to my guys and, you know, help them along with those kind of areas if that, you know, if they need be. So kind of, there's not a whole lot. I've been doing, you know, mixed martial arts for 18 years now. And started like with mixed martial arts. So I've kind of got a good grasp. I've seen it all. I've been real fortunate to work with a lot of great coaches and a lot of great camps over the years, and just kind of taking, you know, tidbits of this and that. Never really had a specific coach for myself. So I've just kind of formulated my own system, my own kind of thoughts and plans and things. And so far we've had really, really great success. So, you know, I'm there to kind of, there's not a question I feel like I can't answer, but if I can't, then there's somebody in this gym that can. We have a phenomenal staff and phenomenal training staff and just group of guys and real good family of fighters too. And, you know, veterans and the older guys that are always willing to step in. You know, Pyle helps people with the diets and all these kind of things. And Tom, you know, it's just a real good environment we have here and a lot of knowledge running around.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned some other coaches that you've either trained under or next to. Is there any coach you look to that has kind of been like an inspiration to the style that you put together?
You know, in the last few years, I was able to, you know, get pretty close with Greg Jackson. And I was able to go out there and do some stuff with him and keep contact with those guys. And Greg has been really kind of cool at mentoring me, you know, when I was making the transition from fighter to coach. And you know, all those guys out there, Greg is, if you ever get to, you know him or talk to him, the guy's a genius. He's an absolute genius at what he does at everything, you know, not just fighting, but he's just got one of those genius minds at work. So if there's things that I'm, you know, struggling with or need advice from, he's usually a guy that I'll give a call to and, you know, talk to him. But he's been really, really cool of learning kind of the do's and the don'ts of, you know, don't do this, do this, you know, through coaching. And that's been a really cool relationship, and I've met a lot of really cool people through him and through that, you know, Jackson's. And I'd say probably he's one of the main guys. And actually, you know, be honest, Pyle himself, you know, he's one of my best buddies and you know, was my neighbor. We lived two streets from each other and been around him for years, and that guy himself has been one of the most I mean, he's probably one of the most smart, educated MMA guys. Like, the dude is a genius on the mat. One of the best guys in the room. I've learned a lot from him over years of training and watching his camps and being part of his camps. And, you know, he's been really good at helping me out too. And, you know, through our years of friendship and things like that, I've picked up a ton of stuff from him.
Those are two definite big names in the MMA community. So to switch off of the concept of big names, we're coming to the end of our interview here. Syndicate MMA, got a lot of guys training there, a lot of gals training there as well. Do you have like one or two names that we should be looking out for in the near future of young talent?
Yeah, I got quite a few. Khalil Roundtree. He's a guy who I've trained his brother, Donovan Freelo, who just fought for the World Series title. Khalil Roundtree is, you know, probably heard his name already. He fights for RFA and got some big things coming up and cannot speak about. But he's going to be a superstar in the making. Donovan Freelo himself, that's another kid. His brother is just, whew, they're both just super studs. Got the resurgence of Roxanne Modafari, you know, an oldie but a goodie. She's going to be making a title run here shortly in Invicta, and I believe she'll end up getting that. The list goes on and on. I got Corey Hendricks, another 205er, 4-0 undefeated. Miles Hunsinger, 5-0 undefeated, RFA. Jamie Moyle, I think she's 4-1 Invicta. We have one thing I've done is really tried to bring up a crew from the grassroots, from the bottom up, all the way from amateur, you know, their amateur careers on up, and spent the last couple of years really focusing on that and picking up some veterans along the way to help out. And it's really starting to blossom. You know, I've had this gym for 13 years almost now. And now is the time where we're really, I can just, like, the fruits of the labor are kind of coming through. We've got so much good young talent. You got Julian Marquez, an undefeated fighter. I think he's fighting at the end of February for Bellator. You just got tons and tons of guys, man. The list goes on and on. We got 5-10 guys to fight for World Series, UFC, you know, just all over. So it's been a really, really cool thing to watch these young kids and even older guys. It's been really great getting the resurgence from the, you know, the veterans that have been around and now are doing really, really well. But across the board, you know, we have a real solid team of about 40, I'd say about 40, 50 fighters on the roster, and everybody's doing real good. Last year, we had a record of, I think it was 54-13 we ended for the year, 2015 or whatever. So we're looking to improve upon that this year and become one of the top teams, which I already believe we are, but I guess just be recognized as one of the top teams.
Yeah, certainly, definitely one of the more underrated names out there. So, John, we really appreciate you spending the time with us, and thanks for giving us the interview.
My pleasure, man. It's great. Anytime.
Man, so I thought both coaches we had on the show today were awesome. I loved how John Wood listed 1,000 prospects he likes.
Yeah, he loves all of his young guys, and you could tell he was kind of a little bit upset that he was forgetting one or two.
And then also what he was saying about the camp itself.
Yeah, the camp itself, highly underrated, and I also liked how both of our coaches listed Greg Jackson as influences.
Yeah, that was kind of cool. He is like the, I hate to admit it because I hate the Patriots, but he is like the Bill Belichick of MMA.
Yeah, he's so cerebral.
All right, so with that being said, we will now move our attention to the former fight card known as UFC 196, a pay-per-view, but when it lost the main event of Fabricio Werdum versus C-level Cain Velasquez, it flipped to a fight night on free TV if you have Fox Sports 1.
UFC Vegas, they're calling it if you've got the hashtag.
Oh, nice. And we are at Top Turtle MMA
I'm at Gumby Vreeland.
Vreeland. For those of you who don't speak Dutch. And the main event of this fight night is Johnny Hendricks versus Stephen Thompson. Johnny Hendricks, of course, coming off a grind-em-out win against Matt Brown last March. He failed to make weight in November against Tyron Woodley, to much fanfare. Going against Stephen Wonderboy Thompson, a favorite fighter of ours, Thompson head-kicked the crap out of Ellenberger this past July. And it's an interesting matchup at the top of the division. It would be Thompson's biggest win to date if he can beat Hendricks. And if Hendricks beats Thompson, you kind of figure he might end up with like a Woodley, maybe one more fight back into title contention. But Gumby, how do you see this one playing out?
I like Thompson. You mentioned he's a favorite of both of ours. And I love his style. The karate style is so fun to watch. But Hendricks is a wrestler by trade. We forget about that a little bit because he threw hands with
Robbie Lawler for 10 rounds.
He knocked out Kampman and Fitch with one punch, both in like 7 or 10 seconds.
I do have to say something about that I wonder is we actually haven't seen him flash that knockdown power in about 2 years now or 3 years now. What do you make of that? Is it just the step up in competition?
I think Robbie Lawler's got one of the best chins in MMA, and right. It's highly underrated how good his chin is. And I think
he rocked GSP once or twice.
Yeah,
in that
yeah.
Fight. Yeah.
He did rock GSP once or twice. He's just not fighting, you know, Kamen's a great striker. Fitch is not so much. He's not fighting guys he can tag like that anymore. And you'll also notice about their general build versus somebody like GSP or Robbie Lawler, a lot skinnier guys, you know.
Right.
So he's probably getting the knockout that way too. But I expect him to wrestle Stephen Wonderboy Thompson. I don't expect him to strike with him. And when he does, I think that this is a fight Robbie Lawler wins in grounded pound.
You mean Johnny Hendricks?
Oh, Johnny Hendricks, yeah. Excuse me, yeah.
They're sort of intertwined because they went back and forth for 10
rounds.
Yeah,
they're pretty much the same guy in that fight, weren't they? Bloody and battered.
That's right. But yeah, the way I kind of see it playing out, and God, would I love to see Wonderboy just kick his head off, but I think Wonderboy is going to come out there in a karate stance. He's going to maybe throw a kick that goes over Johnny Hendricks' head because there's a massive height difference. Hendricks is going to come under that leg and take him down and
be on the back right
away. Night nurse. Yep. That's going to be what we'll watch for about 4 to 5 rounds.
I expect this to be a Hendricks grappling clinic.
Yeah. But it'll be, you know, listen, if Hendricks wants to stand and trade there with Wonderboy, I mean, I'd love to see it.
Yeah.
All right. So the heavyweight offering on the card, the co-main event, if you will, now is pretty interesting, Gumby. It's Roy Nelson on a 3-fight losing streak, actually, against Jared Rochalt, the young up-and-comer from Team Takedown, who we spoke to a couple weeks ago, on a 3-fight win streak. What do you make of this one?
So that seems backwards, right? Because they don't even like doing a guy off of one loss versus a guy off of one win. And here they got 3-fight losing streak versus 3-fight winning streak. And it's an interesting one to me because Rochalt's got that wrestling. But as far as striking goes, I think this is Roy Nelson's fight. Intentionally, it's setting him up with a prospect he can beat. Because while Rochalt is working on his striking, he talked to us about working on his striking, it isn't there yet for Roy Nelson. And he could come out and prove me wrong, but I expect Roy Nelson to be headhunting here, and it only takes one from Roy.
Yeah, it's almost worth noting, too, that Rochalt had what many people called the most boring fight on the card at the Rousey home pay-per-view card in Melbourne, Australia. And I just think that the UFC was probably like, all right, you want to grind out wrestling fights? We're going to give you someone with knockout power.
Yeah. And Roy Nelson has surprisingly good takedown defense, too. I think that's what people forget about. You know, he stuffed one or two from Barnett in there and really made you think, you know, like, this guy can keep it on his feet if he wants to. I again, think we just sell him short based on his physique alone. And it always sells him short. But he's got that big right hand. He stops some takedowns. And if Rochalt can't get him down, I don't see it as a fight he can win.
Yeah, agreed. So you're so far going Hendricks and Roy Nelson all day.
That's correct. Yes.
Then you have Rafael Feijão. Calvacante is taking on OSP. Feijão's coming off 2 losses in a row, one to Patrick Cummins by TKO, a decision loss to Ryan Bader. Where have I heard that before? And OSP is coming off a disappointing loss to Glover Teixeira. He was kind of on the rise there. I think they were trying to market him almost as a fun up-and-coming fighter. And then Glover just put a stop to that hype train. How do you see this one playing out?
I think this is an OSP fight all day because while his hype train was up leading into the Teixeira fight, I think it's real. I think he really belongs in the top of this division. And it's only going to take him one or two more to get in here, and this is a good one to start. His grappling can be surprising. You know, you forget he's one of the guys, few guys who's ever sunk in a Von Flue choke in the UFC. and he's long, super athletic. He played college football at Tennessee. Just, you know, overall a phenomenal athlete, and I think this is his fight to win.
Yeah, agreed. Then you have Joseph Benavidez versus Zach Makovsky. Makovsky's 1-2 in his last three. Benavidez is coming off a four-fight win streak since his loss to Demetrius Johnson at the end of 2013. You know, again, to much Twitter hype, it looks like Benavidez has made the switch to Muscle Farm, if I'm not mistaken. There was a picture going around online.
I don't think he's made the move there. I think he's still technically alpha male represented, but he's definitely doing some training there. Which, I don't know, that just, it's interesting to me.
I swear to God, if Fight Pass wants a show that's going to capture the hearts of millions, just do a Beverly Hills 90210 style drama about all these guys switching fight camps and the fallout that comes from it.
Yeah, I'd hate to say I'd watch it, but...
You'd watch
it. I'd watch that, yeah.
So how do you see this fight playing out, Gumby? Convince me that Zach Makovsky has a chance.
You see, and that's just what I was about to say. So I would, if I was a betting man, which I am, put money on Joseph Benavidez.
Sure.
But I do think that the odds are a little bit too skewed in his favor, because I think Zach Makovsky brings enough wrestling to the game to make this a striking battle with Joe Benavidez. And as far as striking goes, I don't think he's that far behind in the striking column either. If he can keep the feet, this becomes a really fun fight. And on the other side of that, if he can get Benavidez down himself, he's in a really good spot.
So Makovsky is, in most sports books, about a plus 325 dog here, but you're saying that you like him maybe in a, if we went parlay hunting, he might be someone you throw some money down on?
Absolutely, especially because, you know, if this were me making the odds strictly based on what I think is the potential outcome and not what I think I could get people to bet at, you know, if I was a bookmaker, I would do, you know, plus 180, plus 200. He's a 2-1 underdog. He's not 3 or more to 1 underdog better. And I think Markowski's got a chance here, and if he does, you're going to see him, you know, pretty darn close to a title shot.
Yeah, so that's interesting and something to watch for, and we know that that division is hungry for new title contenders.
Yeah, apart from Cejudo, who is there.
Yeah. Do we know when Cejudo's next fight is?
No, I mean, he's fighting Mighty Mouse, I assume, but I just don't know when.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, continuing on in the main card, happy news to report. Our boy, we interviewed him 2 weeks ago, Misha Serkinov, made it to the main card, Gumby, against Nicholson.
Yeah, and he was talking on that interview about possibly making it to the main card, and it's great to see that he made it there. Super humble guy, a lot of fun to watch. And he's fighting Alex Nicholson there, who is his first fight in the UFC, but he's won a bunch in a row. I believe he's a 6-1 prospect.
That is correct.
A lot of fun to watch. But our boy Serkinov, don't get me wrong, when I requested an interview with Misha Serkinov, there was a reason why I did. I really truly believe that this guy is one of the future names at 205 pounds.
He's like the one prospect in the UFC at 205.
He's the prospect I'm excited about.
He's 1-0 so far in the UFC.
Amazing judo. He teaches no-gi at Extreme Couture. He's 1-0 in the UFC, and he is going to take Alex Nicholson down, and he's going to do bad things to him.
Last fight on the main card, you have Mike Quicksand Pyle. Really, it should be Mike the Mullet Pyle. He has one of the best mullets in sports. He's 1-2 in his last three, Gumby. He's going to be facing Sean Spencer. How do you see this one playing out?
So I like Sean Spencer because I've seen kind of some fun fights out of the Octagon MMA guys.
Also 1-2 in his last three fights, Sean Spencer.
Yeah, but as you heard in that interview with John Wood, you know, Mike Pyle is just one of the most knowledgeable guys you know. He's been around forever. Seems like the guy's got 1,000 fights, and he can take it anywhere. You know, I've seen some really good ground game out of him from time to time. I've seen some really good stand-up game from him from time to time. And I think his well-roundedness is going to get the better of Spencer here. You know, Spencer's got some tools in his tool bag, but I don't see this as a fight that he can pull off almost strictly on experience alone. You know, I don't mind Sean Spencer's wrestling, but, you know, is he going to get Mike Pyle on? If he does, he's going to get more than he can handle on the ground.
Yeah. Moving to the FS1 prelims. Now, these are the prelims, so you don't have to change the channel going from prelims to main card tonight because it was formerly a pay-per-view. Now it's on FS1. You have Derek Lewis fighting Damian Grabowski. Derek Lewis is 2-1 in his last three. What can you tell us about Damian Grabowski, and what are you thinking here at Gumby?
So Damian Grabowski, he's a Polish prospect. A lot of fights on his record. He's 20-2 right now. And he's got only one win in a row. He's coming off a
it was an arm triangle choke.
Arm triangle choke.
Polish promotion? Yeah. Or, no, it was an M1 challenge.
M1 challenge,
which is a big Russian promotion.
I mean, Russian, they sometimes fight in Poland. You know, he's a good heavyweight prospect. I almost think they kind of rushed to get him there coming off of a loss. He's got some real, like, weight behind him in some wrestling. Obviously, he's a heavyweight. He's got tons of punching power. Derek Lewis is a really big riddle for me at heavyweight because sometimes he looks so good, sometimes he looks so bad. You know, against Mitrione, he looked awful, and other times he's looked phenomenal. And I think, you know, while Grabowski is a good prospect, I think this is one of the times we're going to see a good version of him. He throws bombs, and he's a big guy. So I'm going with the Bama Beast by overwhelming knockout.
By overwhelming knockout. I like that. And then further on the FS1 prelims, you have the veteran Josh Berkman. Since coming back to the UFC, he had a loss that was turned into a no contest because Hector Lombard popped for steroids and then followed that up with two more losses. So really, he's 0-3 in the UFC, or you could say, since his return, or you could say he's two losses, one no contest. He's going up against KJ Nunes, who is 1-1-1. He has a win over Sam Stout. He lost to Alex Oliveira, and he had a no contest overturned by Derek Cruikshank. It was an accidental eye poke. How do you see this one playing out?
Nunes has got some really fun kickboxing, which is why I like that matchup with Darren Cruikshank before the eye poke ended it. But the thing about him is that I think when the bright lights get on, he underperforms a little bit. And Josh Berkman has that big show experience. Josh Berkman tapping out, John Fitch, leaving him cold in the middle of the World Series of Fighting Cage. I think Berkman, as long as he can get inside of a couple of those kicks, submission game wise, grinding wise, Berkman's a better fighter here.
All right, so you like Berkman.
I like Berkman.
All right, then a flyweight offering on the Fight Night prelims. You have Ray, Resistance is Futile Borg. That's a Star Trek reference, going against Justin Scoggins. Scoggins is 1-2 in his last three. Borg is on a 3-fight win streak. I know you're a big fan of Borg. How do you see this one going down?
So first of all, I'd like to say I'm a little bit upset that you didn't mention his real nickname, because the Taz Mexican Devil
is pretty cool.
Is a great nickname. Taz Mexican Devil, phenomenal nickname by Ray Borg. Yeah, and you know I'm a big fan of Borg. A while ago, I told you when we were talking about gambling one time on the mats, I said, always bet Ray Borg. And that's really my slogan too, because, I mean, he came in on a short notice fight and put in a hell of a match against Dustin Ortiz, a match that I thought he won on short notice. And his grappling is just really top-notch. Scoggins has got really fun karate, and he's got that long stance. Borg's going to get inside of that. Borg's going to be on the ground with him, and he's not going to want to be on the ground with Borg.
All right, so Borg all day.
Yeah, Borg submission.
You're not going away.
Markdown submission.
Wow, yeah. Okay. You feel very confident about that.
Always bet Ray Borg.
Real bullish on Ray Borg. All right, and then the last offering in the FS1 prelims, you have Noad Lahat, who's 2-1 in the UFC. He'll be going up against Diego Rivas, who is 1-0 in the UFC, coming off a win off Rodolfo Rubio Perez.
Yeah, he's one of those ones coming off of that the Latin American season of The Ultimate Fighter, or the Mexican season of The Ultimate Fighter. He's a fun pick, but I don't know that he's ready for a step up like Noad Lahat. Lahat is a black belt in jiu-jitsu and a third-degree black belt in judo, if I'm not mistaken. His grappling is really superior, and you got to remember a lot of those guys in tough Latin America were fighting at gyms that were not big-name gyms for a really long time. And yeah, he might have made the switch now, and he might have gotten significantly better, but he's going up against a guy who's been there forever. You know, like Noad Lahat has been training high-level jiu-jitsu, high-level judo for a really long time, and Rivas has not. And I think that you're going to see the difference there.
Got ya. So now there were 6 fights on the main card, kind of a weird configuration for this Saturday, Gumby. 6 fights on the main card, 4 on the prelims, and then only 2 on Fight Pass. We'll get to, let's call it the main event of Fight Pass in a second, but we'll start out with Alex White, who is 1-2 in the UFC, going against Artem Lobov, who is Conor McGregor's sidekick on this latest season of The Ultimate Fighter. We saw him lose in the finals by decision to Ryan Hall. Kind of a weird fight. Ryan Hall took it on short notice. I don't think Lobov was really prepared to deal with the ground attacks and the leg lock attacks of Ryan Hall, but we definitely saw that he had power on the Ultimate Fighter. How do you see this one playing out against Alex White?
If you had only seen Lobov in that fight, I would pick against him every time. But knowing the power he has and the shots he can take, they found him the perfect opponent. White is going to stand in front of him and bang. And, you know, maybe he'll turn to wrestling because he knows that might be a weak point in Lobov's game. But as long as he's on the feet with Lobov for a while, Lobov is going to land that left hand. I like the way that he throws the left hand. I like how it looks. And I think this is a probably either way that it's going, it's going to be a knockout. But I like Lobov hitting the knockout punch earlier.
All right. And then bringing us home is the main event of the Fight Pass prelims, you could call it. And it's really for the CM Punk title because, I mean, I think they've announced that the winner of this will fight CM Punk. It's not just Mickey Gall anymore. Okay, right. So the winner of Mickey Gall versus Mike Jackson is going to get professional wrestler or former professional wrestler CM Punk in his first UFC fight sometime this summer. We're assuming 199, UFC 199 in June. Mickey Gall is 1-0 as a professional. He was the star of Looking for a Fight, the Fight Pass show, where Dana White goes around looking for prospects of episode 2, and that was in Dead Serious MMA. He looked very impressive. He's a young guy, early 20s. He's going to be going up against friend of the show, Mike, do not call him Michael Jackson, who is also, he's making his UFC debut as well. And actually doesn't have any professional fights at
age
30.
That's right. He's 0-0, and we talked to him a little bit about that. On the interview, he's a very confident guy, really fun guy. And if you've watched any of his fights, he's got pretty dynamic striking. I've seen a couple of his amateur bouts. They're fun to watch. The one thing I do worry about with Mike, and I do like Mike, obviously, from our interview, is that I'm a little bit worried about his grappling. And Mickey Gall, I feel like in what I've seen of him, has got a pretty good well-rounded base. And I'm a little bit worried that that's going to be the end of Mike Jackson. And you're going to see him out-grapple him. And really, I think that's what they want for CM Punk as far as an opponent goes, is somebody who will grapple him. So I'm going to go with Mickey Gall here, even though Mike Jackson's not going to like that listening to our show.
No, I understand. We have to be fair about it. I really like Mike Jackson. Follow him on Twitter. He's a really funny guy. Tons of personality.
Go to his website, too. He's a hell of an interesting website.
There's like burlesque reviews on there or something.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
He had a funny thing on Twitter the other day. He said, my mom just came in the room and asked if we could order pizza, and I told her I have a fight next week.
Like, she didn't know he was on the biggest stage.
But yeah, it seems like Mickey Gall's fight to win. He's 23. I think they want to get as much equity as they can out of whoever beats CM Punk, assuming whoever faces him is probably going to beat him. And Mickey Gall is a young star building a name off the win off CM Punk. Seems like how they're trying to write the script.
Yeah, and I think that's just what you're going to see. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he's a grappler, too, and that the grappler just happens to be a little bit better than the striker here, that just sets up the Punk matchup so well.
All right, well, that does it for UFC, formerly UFC 196, the pay-per-view, now Ultimate Fight Night 82 on FS1. Gumby, it's been a fun show. Where can people catch you and your writing?
So make sure that you head over to MMAManifesto.com. That's MMA-Manifesto.com. Make sure you head on over there for all the news and the content. You can follow me at Gumby Vreeland on Twitter, and make sure that you check out the Stitcher to listen to this podcast.
You can catch us on Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn,
SoundCloud. You can get us just about anywhere now.
Just about anywhere. You could find us on MMA-Manifesto.com. We have a page there under the podcast tab, and you can also follow us on Twitter at TopTurtleMMA. You could email us TopTurtleMMA@gmail.com. I am David Tremonti. I was joined by Daniel Gumby Vreeland. We are going to open mat. When you get to the top turtle position in MMA, you should always be looking to finish. We are top turtle. We are finished.